So anyways, this week we're talking about COINTELPRO, which is shorthand for counterintelligence program, coming out of the FBI. Like I said, we're just going to focus on kind of an overview and how it relates to the repression of indigenous movements. I think what's really important to think about is to put this into historical context. The FBI, you know, was created and founded in 1919. But before I get into that, I want to kind of set the stage a little bit historically and why, as indigenous peoples, indigenous leftists and Marxists, we need to study the arms of the state. And I think I just want to put forward like a theory of imperialism into understanding the machinations of the police state, because it's important to remember that the primary mode of repression of indigenous peoples at the founding of the settler republic was the U.S. military. And in fact, there are 14 battle streamers on the U.S. Army flag that represent the so-called Long War against indigenous people. The first battle streamer is 1791, and the last one is 1891. So over 100 years of war against indigenous people. In 1891, also kind of marks a transition. You have, you know, the Dawes Allotment Act being pushed through. You have the inauguration of the reservation period, as it's known. The Dawes Allotment Act, you know, basically put up for sale to white settlers around 270 million acres of territory, which was devastating to tribes. And, you know, it's that acreage is about the size of the state of Montana. So it was a huge land grab. But it didn't just happen because Native people were like hapless victims. There was resistance. There's, you know, the Standing Rock Nation, the Lakota, the Ocheti Shakoi, adamantly resisted allotment the first time it came around, and only subsequently agreed to allotment because their children were taken and sent to off-reservation boarding schools. But also what was implemented was what was called the Civilization Regulations, which is essentially a series of internal circulars that were sent out by the Commissioner of Indian Affairs regulating daily aspects of Native life. That included anything from speaking language, speaking your language, practicing your ceremonies, sun dancing. And even I found this one, which was really fascinating. It was about how to butcher a cow and how to butcher and the kinds of things that Native people were allowed to eat. So there was a ban on eating organ meats because it was considered savage and it was considered barbaric. So like everything down to our diets, to our governance structures, was micromanaged by the U.S. government, and they implemented what was called the Courts of Criminal Offense or Courts of Indian Offenses, which one could be brought up on, you know, and as punishment they could be jailed or imprisoned, or they could have their rations withheld. So it was a starvation policy, and you also see at this moment in time the professionalization of the Indian Scout Service. Or not, it's not really a service, but Indian scouts who were kind of auxiliaries to the U.S. military becoming actual police forces on the reservations at this time. And it might just be, we can look at it through the lens of settler colonialism, which is incredibly important, and thinking about how these regulations weren't just about physically killing Native people, but culturally, politically, economically destroying them as nations. And to kind of put that into a little bit of perspective, if you think about the Black Hills case, which the Lakota Nation, the Ocheti Shakoi, has refused, you know, has brought a charge against the United States saying that the Black Hills was illegally taken, right? And they were sold or given away under a seller starve policy. Essentially, we would get our treaty annuities revoked had we not agree to selling the Black Hills. It's a whole case. We should do an entire episode on it. It's really worth thinking about. But what happened, though, because of that case, but also because of the mounted resistance that specifically the Ocheti Shakoi, but also other indigenous nations like the Apache, you know, the Comanche, had fomented against the United States, and it was successful. You know, they defeated the U.S. Army in open combat. There were generations of punishment, right, to force the hand and to eliminate indigenous leadership. So if we think about the blockade on Cuba, which is like 6 decades long, or we think about sanctions against, you know, hostile or non-compliant nations, specifically like socialist nations, but others, we can think about this policy as being implemented against indigenous people, probably first and foremost, preventing us from developing our own government structure, you know, in spite of all of this, in spite of, you know, the economic, the political, the cultural assault on our nations for generations over a century, you know, almost a century and a half, we've refused to sell the Black Hills because it's not about money. It's about autonomy. It's about political rights. It's about sovereignty. It's about independence, right? And I think that's important to put into the conversation because at the turn of the century, several decades before the FBI was even formed, there was a large influx of Western European immigrants who had been expelled from Europe during the revolutions, during the Paris Commune, et cetera, and were bringing what were considered alien ideologies like Marxism and communism. So a new way that Native people were being racialized and being targeted was because we held quote unquote communistic views. And there's plenty of evidence. I could do an entire podcast episode on that about how these policies of allotment, which were meant to encourage private land ownership, these are policies of assimilation, of civilization, were actually attacking the tribe to break up this idea of common ownership of land, but also communalism within indigenous communities, because they weren't anti-capitalist, but they definitely were non-capitalist. And if we think about this in a Marxist sense, you know, it's about the kind of economic drivers of why one takes land and also providing a political alternative that sustains resistance through maintaining a distinct cultural base through language and nationality, but also because attacking Native nations meant opening up the land on one hand, but also it meant forever like suspending the question of independence, the question of sovereignty, to a point where indigenous people, you know, were confined to reservation life and weren't allowed to really evolve. And I use that word, you know, critically, but to evolve beyond the status of dependency on the, you know, with the United States. But the other aspect of it, and looking at it from kind of an anthropological perspective, Marxist anthropological perspective, is that if we think about the way that indigenous nations had developed their culture, and it's not just culture in an abstract, we're talking about how resources were redistributed, how life was reproduced, how social life was reproduced, how harmony was desired or aspired to with what we call, you know, in English, nature. There's no word for nature in Lakota'api. There's no external to human society. Like, we are nature and nature is us.
I mean, the closest thing that I think actually encapsulates what white people, you know, want to, like, call nature is, like, glaciation, like, that which moves. Mm. Like, that's the only... Nashka. Yeah, like, that's the only thing that's comes to mind, and I'm
but
it, like...
But that concept includes us.
It's so much... Well. Yeah, exactly. Like, I always say to white people, you need to stop thinking of yourselves as separate from nature or above nature. We are one with nature, you know? And like, what we do affects it.
Yeah, and if you think about it in terms of like base superstructure, and I know there's a lot of people who don't like that, but I'm all about that base. The base superstructure is that, you know, this idea that human societies create their culture or their superstructure, their language, their religion, their law, their politics, based on their mode of production or their economy, how they actually sustain themselves on the land that they live and on this planet. And ours was a non-capitalist. Again, I'm not going to make the argument that we were anti-capitalists at this moment in time, but it was definitely non-capitalist, meaning...
Well, I mean, it's impossible to make that argument because, like, capitalism is just emerging at this moment as we see it today. Like, arguably, we could say anti-colonialist.
Yeah, but definitely anti-colonial.
Anti-capitalist is you're jumping the gun to a superstructure that doesn't exist yet.
Yeah.
You know?
And so they knock out the base, our non-capitalist way of living with the land, and they see the remnants of the superstructure through our language, our reciprocity, our communalism, the way we still had relations with the non-human world is the primary threat. And so they attack that base, right? And so that, I think it's important to set that up. The other aspect of it is thinking about imperialism and capitalism on a world scale, and especially the United States. The United States had the largest GDP in the world, not at the turn of the century, in the inauguration of the so-called American century, but in 1830 because of plantation slavery. So the imperialist project began way before the typical American story of empire, you know, says like with the Spanish-American War, etc. And what's important to remember about this is that it's operating on two fronts. One is, you know, at the turn of the century, in the 19th century, the 20th century, it's operating on two fronts. It's looking at the kind of imperialist project abroad, building up its military. And arguably, you know, we had an interview with Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz about this. That began with the founding of this country. But for the sake of this podcast and this episode, I think it's important to think about how value is extracted from these other so-called colonies, overseas colonies, that the United States is creating and fortifying through overseas military bases, through interventions, through basically controlling the economic, political, and social livelihoods and destinies of other nations, and how it's extracting that value from there and creating what we now know as the first world, the most advanced capitalist nation in the world, which is the United States. But instead of redistributing that wealth, which it does to some degree, but it's not necessarily a social democracy or a social liberal democracy like Canada or the Nordic countries, it invests that money into two institutions that maintain its hegemony. The first one is the military, which we could talk about later. But I think for the purposes of this podcast, it's also the repressive apparatuses of the state, the agents of repression, you know, to quote the book title of War Churchill. And so it's important to remember that, like, imperialism, yeah, there is an aristocracy of labor. There are, you know, workers in the first world that definitely benefit from imperialism. But anytime an alternative to that economic system arises, it's crushed by agents of repression, by police forces that seem to have never ending, you know, no limits on their budget and the amount of resources and impunity that they can mobilize at their expenses to crush any alternative that sort of arises in the domestic sphere. I don't know if you want to add anything to that. I could jump into the creation of the FBI and our homeboy
Ward.
Hoover.
I'm just thinking about how Ward words it, which he like places it with the Pinktons and stuff like that. But
yeah,
I mean, like, there's a bunch of different places you can start with the origins. But I mean, like, I think the most important thing to talk about is that dominating paranoia, mistrust, and almost fear of the state that like is just prevalent throughout the society. I mean, like, that's right-wing libertarians, that's exactly what's wrong with them. Like, they literally just fear the state, and oftentimes like anarchists, leftist anarchists or whatever, if you want to, you know, make a difference between libertarian rights and libertarian lefts, you know, they're just afraid of a state too, because they're so used to this, you know, imperial project where I mean, like, it literally seems like the crucible of their, you know, designs is the Indian Wars. Like, when you look at Afghanistan and stuff, like, we've covered this multiple times now on the feed, specifically for the reason that it is so pertinent to the conversation right now. When you even look at, like, the major civil rights movements, you know, of Indian people, those are the first ones getting called communists. Like, you have a fishing rights struggle, and they're getting called communists.
Well, they get, like, I mean, this happens in the 1910s when they formed the Society of American Indians. Like, they're getting labeled communistic because, like, the height, you know, it's like 1917, the United States is entering, you know, World War One. There's the Bolshevik Revolution, the Communist Revolution in Russia, and these American Indian activists are like, we need rights too. We're nations too. And they were getting labeled as, like, red reds, essentially.
Well, like, I mean, better red than dead, you know, has a very specific meaning to at least, you know, indigenous people when they say it, at least communist indigenous people, you know, like, there is very much a dual, like, hatred so to say, that's just systemically intertwined with, you know, but the FBI, just due to its origins, like, I mean, there's a fog of, like, disinformation, if you will. I mean, over-information, misdirection, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's sort of, like, the whole goal of this series is to sort of, like, fuss that out for people to understand better. But, like, I don't know, COINTELPRO to me is, like, one of the more confusing projects, if you will, of the CIA. Because it technically ends.
FBI, you mean?
FBI, yeah, sorry, not CIA. One of the alphabet agencies. But, you know, it never, well, it ends, but it doesn't end. You know, it continues on after 71, even though it's, they released it. You know what I mean? Like, they try to get ahead of the Citizens Committee. So it's like, you know, when that.
Let's take it. Look, as before we get into that, let's do. I'll do a quick overview of the FBI and the formations and the reasons why it was.
Okay,
formed.
Yeah.
That way, I think it'll have a better idea. And I'm gonna actually begin with what I was talking about with like the Society of American Indians, which often gets written off as, you know, kind of like a liberal, like assimilationist. And you know, there are tendencies within that, and it's important to hold that in your mind, but. You know, Society of American Indians was founded in like the 1910s. It was modeled after the National Congress of, or what is it called? NAACP. I can't remember. It's modeled after that. And, you know, it drew a lot of inspiration and support from somebody like W.E.B. Du Bois. But where they ran into kind of trouble, because they're advocating for native rights. We weren't technically citizens at the time. We didn't get citizenship until, citizenship wasn't imposed until 1924. But there were figures such as like the Apache medical doctor, Carlos Montezuma, who was, you know, former SAI member, Society of American Indians member. And he actually became very militant and opposed to World War One. And he actually drew, you know, suspicion by the federal government. He actually, you know, protested this 1917 Selective Service Act. You know, this is a quote from him. He says, "It tells the country that we are competent soldiers," meaning the Selective Service Act, "but we are not competent citizens. We are nothing but wards. We are not citizens, and we are without a country in this world. The wards are called upon to protect the protectors." This actually drew surveillance, by what later became the FBI. You know, and they were surveilling people such as the socialist presidential candidate, Eugene V. Debs, who was actually, you know, charged with under the Espionage Act and the 1918 Sedition Act. You know, he was imprisoned for this. And so they were actually thinking that Native people might join this. And it's important to also point out that there was the Green Corn Rebellion in 1917 that opposed the draft as well. And it was led by Muskogee. IWW, International or Industrial Workers of the World, people who had allied with sharecroppers, black sharecroppers and white sharecroppers in Oklahoma, and planned an uprising to protest the war. So this idea that, you know, somehow indigenous people in this time period were passive or whatever, complacent, is completely, the evidence doesn't bear out. And later on, of course, you know, you get the formation of the FBI, which was modeled in Hoover's image. And, you know, as much as the FBI likes to promote itself as like a crime fighting unit, it cut its teeth under Hoover as basically being political police. And this is important to remember as well, because you have the, what is that TV, the Osage murders? There's a new movie coming out about it. What is it called? The Summer of the Flowering Moon or something like that? Summer.
Oh, I totally just saw a commercial for this shit.
Yeah, so Summer of the Flower Moon. Or wait, Killers of the Flower Moon. I apologize.
Yeah, I have it. Actually, I have the... somebody just recommended that on Truanon, I want to say, the book that it's based off of. So, like, yeah. I was like, oh, man, okay.
This is like propaganda, you know? This is like, so like basically it paints the FBI as these heroic figures who go in and investigate this series of Osage murders and murders of Oklahoma natives, because there was like, they were basically implementing a process of conservatorship, much like Free Britney movement, by the way. It has of everything is settler colonial. Like even Free Britney is settler colonial. But basically, like much like, you know, how Britney Spears was put into a conservatorship by her parents, Native people were considered incompetent and put into conservatorships by guardians, which were mainly like white dudes, who basically were trying to steal oil wealth from Osage people because there was oil discovered there. There was a huge boom, and they would go in and they would target women specifically. And, you know, there's awful accounts. I don't have time to get into it. But like Zeke Kala Shah, who was Ihonktowa, she was, you know, a product of the boarding school era, also a member of SAI, did amazing reporting on it, advocacy in Congress. She's not, they didn't even bother to fucking list her in, you know, in the movie or even in the book that came out. It's as if like we're just hapless victims. I just wanted to point that out. So if you watch that movie, like think about it, because it, think about the way it paints the FBI. When there were indigenous activists who were on the ground, like advocating for tribal nations during this time. So yeah, like the FBI has long engaged in like this public relations campaign to portray itself in a positive light. There's all these FBI movies, right? There's this, the Killers of the Flower Moon, right? We have coming out, like, and it's kind of weird that they came out with it in this moment in time, because you have MMIW, you know, like in the national attention, like murder missing indigenous women. And now they're saying like, oh, the FBI has always been on this. And it's like, wait a second. Like, when have you been investigating murdered missing indigenous women?
Well, if
when
you
did
think
you actually
about it,
care?
If you actually think about it, it kind of makes sense that this movie's coming out as the 50th anniversary of AIM is coming up in 2 years. Where there is going to be people bringing up anime repeatedly because it is a constant, you know, it's one of those stories that vilifies AIM perfectly, yeah. You know?
Yeah, and we'll get into that. I mean, that's like that's a whole nother
whole episode and a book and a podcast.
So the FBI is really created in the image of somebody like Hoover, who's like, you know, he's a character, you know, there's a lot to say about him, but he wasn't, there's a lot of criticism about him not actually ever like really being a cop. Like he was just more of a desk, you know, a desk monkey and sitting behind his desk, you know, issuing orders and things like that. So he wanted to portray this tough guy image. And so even the crime fighting thing, you know, they went after Dillinger and all that stuff. It was most of their work was basically targeting immigrants who held leftist views, you know? And so it's important to put that out there and to think about how the FBI becomes this sort of bloated bureaucracy, this institution who like just essentially justifies its own existence because it's surveilling, you know, or collecting intelligence on, you know, the daily lives of millions of people, right? Like millions of people, not in 2021 terms, but millions of people in like 1920s and 1930s terms.
Writing everything on a piece of paper, yeah. Notepads.
Yeah. So, I mean, the founding of the FBI is explicitly anti-communist is what I'm trying to like get at. And anything that can be labeled, like much like indigenous people, like the Indian Wars, how they use the figure of the Indian to justify the war on terror, communism becomes that kind of political vehicle. Like anything that's, you know, can be made or labeled subversive or communistic is now the terrain or the purview of the FBI and its political campaign against any kind of alternative to capitalism. So the FBI fashioned an image of itself as a crime fighting organization. It's like the antithesis to the mafia. We always hear about like how like the FBI is like fighting the mafia. There's all these like Whitey Bulger movies coming out, but we know that like even when they were supposed to be fighting the mafia, they were actually paying the mafia.
They were good friends. And yeah, well, like that show FBI that was on back in the day, like that show, like they never fought the mafia in that show, really. It was always drug dealers and freaking, you know, they always try to relate it to ideas people associated with like the left. You know, it was very much a targeted campaign, even in the media.
Yeah. So I have the perfect example of,
oh no,
this is called the American Indian Mafia. So this is written by Joseph Trimbach. I've read most of it. And basically, like, you know, he
Read the Oliver North quote.
Yeah, okay, the Oliver North quote. He says, a gripping, no holds bar account, Oliver North. But no, this is a good book because it's like, it gets to like what I'm saying. It's like, even it has to frame like the American Indian movement as a criminal organization. Like it's fighting the mafia. Like AIM is literally, the American Indian movement is the mafia. So this, you know, the origins of that kind of accusation or like justification for the FBI and its overreach and everything that it's doing literally comes from Hoover. Like it's the Hoover playbook, you know, just make it look like the mafia. Well,
yeah. How long was he in charge of the FBI anyway? It was forever, right?
Yeah, he was the director from like the 20s to the, I think, 1971.
He was 38 when he became in charge and then died.
Yeah, he died in office. I mean, it became like a third or a fourth branch of government, essentially, because he would target his political opponents. He would, you know, even the presidents, you know, he would spy on them. But yeah, so I think it's like it's important to point out that, you know, this book, or excuse me, this the FBI is just, you know, it's essentially a. It's a political, they're political police, essentially, is what they are. And, you know, their tactics really kind of pick up in, you know, I mean, they've been doing this for several decades, but they really pick up in the 50s. They have this Kommunfell, which means communist infiltration, to basically infiltrate labor organizations, communist parties, socialist parties, disrupt them. And so from the FBI emerged in the era of McCarthy, right? This idea that there was this, you know, all these communists that had infiltrated all the echelons of government and the media. And so they became, you know, they became the political police force that was tasked to essentially crush, you know, the communist movement. So I wanted to give that little brief overview of the FBI, and it's, you know, there's a lot more to say. I'm sure we'll get into it in other podcast episodes, but I just wanted to have that as like a basis, understanding it from a Marxist perspective, from an indigenous perspective, as well as understanding that the goal of the FBI in these moments of time, and since its origin, it believed in, like, even though its mandate was domestic surveillance, domestic policing, it extended well beyond that. And it believed that it had to protect the homeland, right, quote unquote, from external foreign enemies, i.e. communism. And to do so, it had to, you know, go beyond the rule of law many times. And so its original mandate, you know, was already being stretched as soon as the ink dried, so to speak, because people turned a blind eye. You know, it's immigrants who are coming in, then it's communists, and then it's black people, then it's Puerto Ricans, then it's, you know, indigenous people. And so people turn a blind eye to this. You know, so it's important to put that out there and to understand, you know, exactly how the FBI came to being and the role that it plays, you know, in this larger, you know, global imperialist project. It's to make sure that there's no alternative arising on the home front, right? While the CIA, you know, its counterpart, operates on the foreign front.
Well, and like, that's literally like, these operations always target groups that could represent a potential threat. And it's always been several programs that encompass an umbrella term. And so that, like, nowadays, like when they say like COINTELPRO would essentially have been back then signature reduction in my mind, you know, like there was multiple things that grouped together in order to create this police force for the national defense of the United States of America, yet for some reason it's claiming to be domestic. You know, its focus is national security, but it's only targeting domestic peoples. And like, especially with like a Native American, it doesn't get more domestic than that, technically. Yeah. You know what
I mean? the original domestic.
It's pretty fucked up to be like, oh yeah, no, we're gonna, these are the people we already have complete control over. Yeah, we need to start surveilling them even further.
Yeah.
I mean, and well, and then like, especially with the murders you were talking about on the Osage Reservation, like one of the ones that reminds me is this dude who went and married a girl just to murder her.
Yeah.
That was a very common practice, you know? Like, it, these things weren't done by, you know, like, whenever we say colonialism wasn't just done by the military, like, settlers had an active hand, and it was because it was essentially incentivized to murder us.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I don't know. I think it's a misleading name oftentimes because, like I said, like, it doesn't stop. Like, the same exact programs seem to continue after the fact the FBI says them they're over.
Yeah, I mean, it has institutional knowledge. It's finding what works and finding what doesn't work and not doing, you know, not repeating the mistakes, but repeating the effectiveness. And so I think it's also important to point out that we only know the FBI because it ended, right? And there's FOIA documents, but we don't know the successful parts of it because those tactics and strategies are being used probably to this day, you know, and perfected in other ways. And we will never know. We will never know just because they won't tell us. Those are state secrets.
Well, I'm a firm believer that the state reveals to us secrets by blaming them on their enemies. And so, like, one of the things I always think about is how they talk about these people who were disappeared at Wounded Knee. And I have no doubt in my mind it was probably people the CIA or FBI disappeared or whatever and then freaking blamed on AIM in order to make Trimbach's book look good. It's not Trimbach's book where they claim the guy was crucified, right?
He includes testimony from that.
Oh, okay, yeah. That's freaking ridiculous. Oh, yeah. My goodness.
Yeah, I mean, this we can't get into it here, but, like, this book was published, I think, in 2007.
Oh, right after Hendrix, huh?
Or 2009. Yeah, so it was published after Hendrix's book. We'll get into all this stuff later. But it was actually during the Anime Aquash murder trials. And so I think he was, like, there to, you know, set the record straight and give the FBI perspective. And he takes, you know, he does, like, really awful book reviews of Spirit of Crazy Horse, Steve Hendrix, like, all these other, what he considers, like, pro-AIM propaganda.
And Hendrix isn't even pro-AIM? Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, he's a character. But, you know, like, I think what's also important is that, like, we can't really get into it here, but it's, like, we're going to do an episode on, like, Leonard Peltier in that case. But you have to remember that, you know, at the shootout at Oglala in June of 1975, that was the first time that, you know, any of these movement organizations had actually killed FBI agents. And they got off. The first two defendants, co-defendants, Dino Butler and Bob Rabideau, with, you know, Leonard Peltier, actually won a self-defense case saying that they acted in self-defense, that these FBIs came in wielding guns and they acted in appropriate self-defense manner because they didn't identify themselves, they didn't know who they were, and so they had to pin it on somebody. And you know, it's a sore spot for them. You know, it's not like we're advocating for, you know, killing or anything like that, but it was a different time and I think it's unresolved. And so retired FBI agents have more leeway in what they can say. Like, they can write memoirs, you know, they can write hit pieces and it doesn't matter if it's true or not, you know? And so, yeah, I think that's important to point out that it's like, this isn't just about destroying organizations like the American Indian Movement, like the Communist Party USA. It's also about destroying the history of them and the memory of them so that they don't carry on.
Well, I don't know. I think one of the big things about AIM and why it was successful is that the memory they were carrying forward isn't just of their organization. They're carrying forward an entire history of genocide that is too apparent to ignore, especially when you consider that, like, the event, like we were talking about, that really sets the scene for AIM, you know, being threatening is the fact that they took over this hamlet in, you know, South Dakota, Wounded Knee, in 1973. And then they end up having this huge presence in, you know, Pine Ridge, my reservation, because to this day they still do, you know, because of the courage, you know. I mean, literally the liberation that they, you know, essentially led. you know, along with the grassroots organizers too. But even like a lot of the grassroots Oglala people called themselves AIM Security at the time. They didn't call themselves AIM, but they said they're AIM Security. So it's, you know, when you can bring about that people power, it's the same reason why Fred Hampton and Malcolm X were targeted. You know, they were spouting this nationalist ideology, claiming that, for lack of a better word, you know, balkanized the U.S. You know, they wanted their own state. You know, there's a huge discussion to be had there. But at the time, you know, when the state you're forced to live in is murdering your people, yeah, it makes sense to want your own state. So, like, of course, Muhammad Ali jumped onto that bandwagon with the Nation of Islam, even. He wasn't even a full-on, you know, communist or anything. But they sure as hell called him a communist as soon as he tried staying home from the draft instead of going into Vietnam. And he had a very good argument for why he didn't want to go to Vietnam. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to point out that it's like there was an FBI designation for, it was called American Indian Protest in the U.S. And this was the FBI, you know, FBI has all these files, they have ways of indexing everything, but that was the index that was being used. And I've traced documents back to the 1960s. Nobody's really written about it. You know, Ward Churchill hasn't written about it. But there's this really amazing treasure trove of documents called the AIM, or the American Indian Movement Wounded Knee FBI files, which are available at most public libraries. There's 20 reels. I think it's around 20,000 pages. But they begin, you know, they begin not with AIM necessarily. They begin with, like, you know, the Mohawk Nation shutting down the bridge between New York and Canada, you know, the United States and Canada. And they're talking about, like, are these militants going to, like, actually take up arms? And then they have, you know, they follow somebody like a Mad Bear Anderson, who's a Haudenosaunee activist, who's like going to Cuba, going to like the third world, and like, you know, like trying to find any allies he can, you know. So they were tracking, like, student movements specifically. They were going to places like the Gallup Ceremonial, which is, you know, a city not too far from here, where the Red Power Movement announced itself as the Red Power Movement, where Clyde Warrior and others founded the National Indian Youth Council and said, we are in the era of red power. We're in the era of militant protests. And this is 1961, I believe. And so they were following this. They were following it. They didn't take it seriously. You can tell by their reports. And they also didn't take women's leadership in these movements seriously. They don't even get named in most of the FBI reports.
Well, like, it honestly provided a very useful, you know, way. Is that what is the saying? AIM was the jawbone, women were the backbone.
Yeah, men were the jawbone, women were the backbone. I think what is their name? Janet McLeod said that.
Okay, yeah. I mean, like, that's a very accurate. I should put the dog down. But that's a very accurate quote in saying that, like, these women, from not being targeted, it was much easier for them to organize everything. And honestly, they did organize everything. They came up with all the good ideas. I mean, when it comes to Mount Rushmore, Madonna Thunderhawks led that, didn't she?
No, actually, it was Lakota Grandmothers in 1970 led the first occupation of Mount Rushmore.
Well, I'm trying to think of Lehman Brightman did a convention speak at an 09 in the fall, last AIM convention, where he says something about Madonna being up the hill already smoking.
Yeah, that was the second occupation in 1971.
Oh, okay.
So there was two. The first one happened in 1970, and it was three Lakota grandmothers. Their names are Muriel Wakazoo, Lizzie Fasthorse. I can't remember the other person's name. Andrea something.
I thought they were all part of the same group.
No, and so they actually started a protest in Sheep Mountain because the United States government during World War, or the U.S. military during World War II, had confiscated hundreds of thousands of acres to make a bombing range, and the tribe was trying to get it returned back to the tribe after World War II, and they wouldn't return it. So they held a protest camp, like a land back movement camp there. And nobody was paying attention. Yeah, because it was like, it was in the middle of nowhere. So nobody was paying attention. And so these Lakota grandmothers were like, well, everyone, like, you know, like 500,000 tourists come to Mount Rushmore, you know, every summer. So like, let's make our stand there. And so they like scaled the mountain during a lightning storm and took it over for several months. And it ended in like November, December, but it sparked kind of like a series. It was part of a series of occupations for land back occupation of the BIA. It was going on during Alcatraz.
And but so you then, also had Fort Snell, the Air Force Base.
Yeah, Fort Snell. AIM occupied that in, I think, 1971. So there was like a series of land back occupations that happened in that time. And this is when the FBI really begins to take notice, not just of the Red Power movement, which they didn't really take seriously, but they began to take serious the American Indian movement. In the initial reports, you know, they have informants and infiltrators going into movements, reporting on them, saying essentially that, like, these are militants. You know, they're talking about guns and bombs, you know, which wasn't true at all. They've gotten training in Cuba, in Cuban guerrilla camps, which would be kind of cool, but I don't think that was true.
I mean, the closest you can get is, like, the kids who went over. Like,
yeah, well, I mean,
that wasn't training.
Well, after Wounded Knee, like, Vernon Belcourt did go to Cuba, and he gave a speech, which is actually a really phenomenal speech. But
well,
they were
Leonard
trying...
Crowdog went there too, right?
Yeah.
With him, and that's actually where he said for the first time he felt like a man.
Yeah, and there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of instances in which, you know, there were connections with left movements, but I don't think they were at least initially. They weren't as like concrete as the FBI was looking for or trying to make it seem. But it is important to, like, let's talk about, you know, the tactics that they employed and that they kind of pioneered with COINTELPRO. Like, COINTELPRO began in the 1950s or 19, it was operational from 1940 to 1971. So it had about like 30 years of institutional experience, and it primarily targeted the Socialist Workers Party, which was like a Trotskyist organization, and then also the CPUSA, which was, you know, Marxist-Leninist organization, infiltrated these organizations, even got informers into the top leadership, and began a campaign of disruption and counterintelligence.
My favorite thing about the CPUSA is how it was something like 60% of their due-paying members were FBI agents or something like that.
I don't think it was 60%, but it was definitely...
It was a lot.
I think it was like 1 in 30 or something like that. At its low point, because it lost a lot of membership. So like 1 in 30 or something like that was paid FBI informants. But in this program, you know, there was this guy named William C. Sullivan, as well as Kartha D. Deloach. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. Don't really care. But they wrote, you know, kind of reflecting back on COINTELPRO. They said, "We were engaged in COINTELPRO tactics to divide, conquer, weaken in diverse ways in organization, meaning left, socialist, communist organizations. And we emerged in that when he entered the FBI, I think it was back in 1941. So this was, you know, this was going on for at least 30 years before it ended. And before it was exposed, you know, for what it was. And those tactics included anything from espionage, targeting the new left, targeting white hate groups. They infiltrated the Klan. The Klan also had a high percentage of informants. It's much easier for them to do that, I'm assuming, than infiltrating like black organizations. CPUSA, they were engaged in counterintelligence and special operations. And then they also created the categories of black extremists, as well as, you know, targeting the Socialist Workers Party. And, oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, just around this time too, people need to like keep in mind that like there was, you know, the Vietnam War is going on. So you had people breaking into, you know, offices to burn draft cards and protests, you know? And so like the Camden 28, who like, when I think about like court cases and stuff, like they got away with it. You know what I mean? Like that pissed the FBI off that in this era, people were winning their legal cases against them, you know?
My people come from the tried, cannot survive as long as the settlers will thrive. Sinners rezone this land, they committed genocide. They don't feel the land, they kill the land. Try to kill the Indian and save the man. Send the slaughter, they poison water from Flint, Michigan to stand and rock. The land is high, the land is hurt. I feel it too, I'm from the earth. My flesh and blood, the color of the dirt. I'm blessed enough to love my mother curse. Talking mother earth, Ujima Kha, La Jota, my Kocha, ah. Washa Ga, give it straight. Hair like the land and it grow at length. Well, peace, yeah. Is a rosebud with nowhere.